My next guest thinks we are underestimating the impact global warming will have on our health. Peter Doherty is a biomedical scientist and won the 1996 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. He's written about biomedical implications of global warming for the latest edition of the Griffith Review. Welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to speak to you. In a nutshell, what concerns you most about global warming when it comes to health?
Well, the implications for health are very broad, Patricia. They've been looked at recently by the British medical journal, The Lancet, that has set up a commission on this, which is going to report regularly over the next few years, looking at the broad medical implications of climate change and a warming planet. And there are many different levels of concern, from direct effects of heat on individuals to the effects on agricultural productivity, to the possibility of drought and starvation leading to conflict, and the worst of all, of course, the possibility even of nuclear conflict. So the Lancet is drawing the net very widely as they think about this.
When did the medical community begin to realise this was actually going to become a serious problem?
It's been on the books for quite some time now, but if you look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, you'll see in each of those sequential reports, they report every 5 years or so, there's a section on medical consequences, and this has been looked at basically all along, because as far as climate change is concerned, the actual climate science of the cause of climate change is really in the hands of the physical scientists. That's the oceanographers and the glaciology people and the astrophysicists and the meteorologists and all the rest of them. But the consequences of climate change that we're concerned with are really the consequences for life. And that's where medical science and environmental science and so forth gets involved.
You've reflected on the importance of ecological stability. Can that stability be maintained, or is it too late already?
Well, the ecosystems are changing all the time in various ways. They change with development, and they change with various human-induced and natural-induced factors. But I tend to think of life, our life, or the individual human being, as a kind of an ecosystem. So naturally enough, when you look at the global consequences of climate change, one thinks in a broadly ecological context. And basically, it's that ecological context that concerns all of us, because all life, in a sense, is interconnected. We, because of our intelligence and our ability to manipulate technology, of course, we skew that in various ways, and we can often protect ourselves against the worst consequences. But there come points at which we can't protect ourselves.
I think that's a really interesting idea you've just raised there, the idea of us being able to create the technologies and to actually protect ourselves to mitigate the effects of climate change. On a health level, where's the line that where you can't actually make any more change, where it's actually become impossible to stem it?
Oh, we'll go on and make change. But, you know, the human organism, or any mammal, if you like, operates within what we call a comfort zone, an ecological comfort zone, and take us out of that comfort zone, even if we can manipulate it in various ways, and we're severely threatened. And, of course, species in nature don't have that capacity to manipulate their environment in the sense we do. I mean, some species do, but others don't. I mean, birds that migrate long distances can change their migration patterns, but many bird species, for instance, have a very limited or no migration pattern at all, and they're essentially sessile. They're tremendously threatened by climate change, because heat has a tremendous effect on bird eggs. And once a bird's laid an egg, it can't really move it around. Human beings are much more mobile. We carry our fetuses around with us, and we can move into a nice cool cave or something, but a bird can't really do that.
We saw how difficult it was for countries to reach a sort of global agreement to reduce carbon emissions in Paris last December. Is convincing governments to think about the health implications just as challenging?
I think it's very difficult for governments to act on this issue. Firstly, it depends on, in democratic governments, it depends on how people vote. So if we think that we're going to see people voting in the next federal election on the basis of who's best from the point of view of slowing climate change, I don't think we're going to see that being a major factor in the election, rather sadly. I think it'll be a much bigger factor with young voters than it is with old voters. But if you look at older voters, many of them are even hostile to the idea of doing anything. They don't believe that anything's happening.
Have you already seen the impact of climate change in your work as what you call a disease detective?
My world is infectious disease. So if you are thinking in terms of the immediate effects of climate change in infectious disease, one of those effects would be seeing, say, mosquito-borne diseases move away from the equator. But I don't think that's what's happening, for instance, with Zika virus, which is an insect-borne disease in America and it's caused in South America and has caused all those problems. That effect hasn't really cut in yet. The types of effects that you would see from the disease point of view are more likely to be associated with people using degraded water supplies. We're degrading waters all over the planet, contaminated water supplies with bacterial causes of diarrhea and all the rest of it. You know, we're getting into some very dangerous ecological situations already, even without climate change, due to the enormous increase in population and to the enormous impact we've had on all sorts of natural resources, including the groundwater we pump. For instance, in India, the Punjab, the great agricultural region, has pumped so much of its groundwater that extremely depleted now, and a lot of the water that is left is heavily loaded with arsenic. So there's all sorts of other issues as well. Climate change is part of a complex which is really the impact of very large numbers of human beings and human beings seeking a better lifestyle on the natural resources of the planet.
How likely is it that we will be able to solve the health issues as they arise? I mean, how competent, if you like, is science to deal with these dilemmas as new ones arise? We've already experienced and really survived many pandemics. Sure. When will the tipping point occur?
Well, we will always compensate and have solutions, I think, for the various problems that climate change will throw at us. But those solutions may, as time goes by, be available to fewer and fewer people, because we have massive poverty in the world already, and we have many people, an increasing number of people, living in what are called euphemistically informal settlements. What these are essentially is refugee camps and essentially slums around major cities. Though we may find medical solutions or solutions in the way we structure things that will be available to those who are in really advanced societies or are relatively wealthy, those solutions very likely will not be available to the poor. And so they will be hit first.
Many thanks for joining us tonight, Peter. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, pleasure to talk. Bye.
That's Peter Doherty. He's a biomedical scientist and a Nobel Prize winner. And you can read his article on this topic in the latest edition of the Griffith Review. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis on your radio till 7:30 tonight.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.